Welcome to the Mama Bear Dares podcast. I'm Leslie.
And I'm Tessie.
And we are sisters. We started this podcast so that we could talk about the things that were interesting and relevant to so many of us. Tessie and I love to find women who are doing amazing things in this world. And we also love to uncover the amazing things that really average people are doing in this world. So we have just a great time getting to know moms, getting to know women who have a mama bear inside them, and learning from their experiences. We all have such unique ways that we move about this world, and we just love to hear about the ways that people move, and we love sharing them with a really generous and supportive community that you all have become. So that's what we do on Mondays and Wednesdays, kind of. Right? But today Absolutely. We are featuring part two of our conversation with one of our other sisters-in-law. I wonder if people wonder how many we have.
That's a great question. On the clip side, there are four of us.
Yeah. There is more.
We have a wellspring of clipshows.
Wellspring of sisters-in-law. But if you haven't already, go back and please listen to part one from Monday so that you have a better idea of where this conversation began. Part two really starts to unpack this idea of privilege. It's a huge topic, Mama Bears. We discuss it all. We discuss what it is, how it affects how we move through the world, and how to unpack our backpack of privilege to affect change in people who might not carry as much as we do.
Right. Privilege is kind of a hot button word right now. I mean, if you're open to the world and you're listening to the news or getting your information wherever you get it, this is a word that's common in a lot of our news outlets and in really people's stories, right? So in today's cultural climate, people are talking about white privilege specifically, what it means to be a white person and the opportunities that come with that. But in our conversation with Kate, we also talk about economic privilege, knowing your financial needs will be mostly taken care of. We also talk about the privilege of time, the opportunity to go on vacations and take time off of school or a career to travel, which is not something that everybody has.
Right. Just growing up in a family that was loving and supporting and encouraging and stable, that's privilege.
Yes.
And we don't often think of it as privilege. But Kate goes on in this interview to prove that it really, really is. And she learns this the hard way with her work in the Brooklyn courthouses. Kate also talks about the privilege of access just to a great public education in K through 12, but also the access to quality college and then advanced degrees. And she'll say, because of her whiteness, because of where she comes from. She also talks about her common name, as well as how she comes across as straight identifying. All of these have worked or contributed to allowing her to move through this world in a different way than people without these things can.
Yeah, I think that we don't recognize that how we were born is often a privilege. And Kate makes a very strong point that she worked really hard to get where she's at. This is not to discount that, right? And Leslie, you and I can attest to the fact that she's not just naturally very intelligent. She is that, but that's not it. She also works very, very hard. She's a voracious reader. She studied hard throughout school. So, of course, she worked hard at school. She works really hard at her job. But the combination of her working hard plus the privileges you just mentioned is really what gives her and us, because we also were born with those, access to a whole other realm of society that people who are just working hard but don't have those other privileges, they just don't have access to.
Yeah, and it's hard to think about. It's hard to acknowledge this.
Yes.
And, you know, if you haven't thought about it before, like, just, this could be a great jumping off point for you. But once you know, like, we're sorry, mama bears, but you're going to probably not be able to stop thinking about it. Yeah. We hear Kate talk about how she kind of lost hope in humanity a little bit. She's built her foundation on the idea that no matter where you lived, your family and significant others always want what's best for you and will try to love you and protect you the best way that they know how. But then she got to New York and started working in the criminal justice system, and she started hearing stories from men and women who had the opposite experience in their lives. From an early age, they had been mistreated, and it made Kate crumble in tangible ways as well.
We've all been there, haven't we? And Mama Bears, maybe you're doing that right now as you start to unpack your privilege. That, like, oh, everything I thought was true is not. And I related to Kate so much in this moment. But for me, this happened when we became foster parents. It really made me question everything for the same reasons Kate talks about. And today there are parts of our cultural climate that make me think, my goodness, everything I thought about the world, that it's filled with decent, loving humans, it's often put into question with stuff I hear people in power saying or things I read on the internet. Some days it takes all the energy I have not to pack up the kids and go live in a remote area in Wyoming or Utah or something, because it just is hard when your whole foundation starts to crumble a little bit.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And that's essentially what part two of our conversation with Kate is about. Not moving to Utah or Wyoming, but how do you go on once you know this about our communities and our country? As always, we try to end the podcast with a little bit of hope, and Kate gives great ideas on how you can engage your community and your country, the leaders of your country, and those with power and influence, like you and others, to change the discourse. And also how you can go about finding nonprofits who are doing really great work, both locally and globally.
Yes, I think our dare really says it all on this episode. So Mama Bear, stick around for the end when we dare you to do something you have probably not done before. It takes a lot of work and energy and maybe a fair bit of research if the idea is new to you, but it's worth it.
It is. That's right. Let's get back into our conversation with Kate. So before we talk about the work that you're doing now, you've used the word privilege a lot, and I think it's one that we all are hearing a lot and trying to understand what exactly privilege is in each individual life. And so obviously you've spoken it as, you know, you're a woman who has the means to move about the world and to find yourself in Sri Lanka for this extended period of time where you were able to kind of struggle through some of those questions of identity and figuring out yourself. You know, you had this privilege of time and the background of coming from a school where you could make these connections and all of those things. But let's just, before we go into the work you're doing now in New York, talk about what do you mean by privilege and what can we ask ourselves in order to define or understand our privilege? Yeah. Or lack of privilege.
Right. I mean, yeah, definitely. I think it's something I'm continuing to learn about every day, I feel like, and become more aware of. For me, it's been so, like, a lot of different elements. And so I think there is the privilege of, like you said, so economic privilege of having money available to me. And even if it's not mine or I don't have direct access to it, knowing that it's there, having, like, a family that has, that is okay financially at the very least. And so being able to, like, just having that kind of, safety net, mm-hmm. incredibly mm-hmm. huge. Growing up with a family that was supportive, that was loving, caring, unconditionally, that's a huge privilege. Like, that stability, that constant mm-hmm. in my life. And those play out every day. So again, like, being raised like that, but having that, like, I could go, the reality is, like, knowing that at any point I could be like, forget this, forget my life, I'm going to go do something else. And if it fails, knowing that, like, I'm going to be taken care of. Like, that's mm-hmm. a huge privilege. I have no desire to do that, but knowing that I could is, like, a huge privilege, or if something were to happen, that I would be okay. Those larger contextual ones. And then there's, like, the daily things, and there's things like being white is a huge privilege, and the way that plays out every single day. So I think the way that it's affected my education, being able to, the way I've been perceived by teachers, the way I've been perceived by employers, the way I'm perceived by anyone I meet based on my race. And I think every person that I interact with is different, of course, and I don't always, so I'm not going to know how my race has affected my everyday interactions, but knowing that the way that we live in a country where institutionally across the board, white people are typically have better opportunities than people of color, has affected me greatly and affects me every day. And knowing that I'm not always going to be able to see that, there's so many little things every day that affect, you know, like I said earlier, relationships with police, relationships with kind of other systems, having worked in the court system, things like that, like being able to see those things every day, and being aware of that, I think that's another huge one. There's ways that privileges build on each other. So those all have interacted to help me in my path to education and to getting a master's degree. And now I have this high education privilege. Did I work hard? Yes, I worked very hard. But there were little things that I may not even be aware of in that whole process that allowed me access to things that if I had been my exact same self, but had a different name and been a different color, that I, or identified in some other different way, had maybe been outwardly not as straight identifying, had been more queer identifying, then that might be another way that someone, if you can just make someone feel uncomfortable because of their own way, and you immediately have a disadvantage in getting a job or getting a good grade or getting access, getting accepted to a program or something like that. So I think that's one large thing. And I think in the same way too, understanding what it means to be a woman, I mean, this is a huge conversation, but and that understanding some of the disadvantages that I may have had as a woman, kind of this idea of like intersectionality. So understanding all those different elements, largely class, race, gender, sexual identity, sexual orientation, like all of those things, and the way that, it's this all kind of like contextual and gradients of creating the day-to-day experience and little things that I may experience. And then like a larger kind of the way they all build on each other in a larger way.
Well, I love asking you that question and feeling able to ask you that question, because I think you are so great at realizing like, yeah, I worked hard. Like I've done a lot with my privilege, and yet I recognize that it's there, and it's not like a source of shame. I think some people, when you ask them to identify their privilege, it's sort of like, well, I don't want to because I just worked hard. I got here because of my own, agency. But you're able to kind of realize both of those things, and that they can play together and that they can coexist in a really great way if you're willing to sort of recognize it and own it, and then take away the feelings of whatever shame it might cause. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and you had to have a reckoning with your privilege because of where you've traveled. At some points in your life, it's been a total in your face. I mean, you've given great examples of when you were in Chicago, when you're in Sri Lanka and Mexico. All of these things have been really in your face about it. But the reality is, obviously, all those same privileges are happening whether you've traveled or not in America, and they're unique to each person. So our listeners might not have the exact same privilege. They might not have a master's. They might not be or have come from an upper middle class family. Privilege looks different in everyone's lives, and you don't always have to come face to face with it. But at some point, we just need to recognize that you can be both an incredibly hard worker, really intelligent, wanting to seek that, and also a recipient of privilege you didn't really do anything to deserve by nature of your birth. I didn't recognize my own until I saw you struggling with yours, because it, like I said, you had to, and maybe not any more so than the last few years when you moved to Brooklyn. Can you just tell us a little bit about what made you, because up until that point you were a traveler, you loved going to different places. So what made you stick it out in Brooklyn, and talk a little bit about your work there?
I think what's made me stick it out is that it feels a little bit like anything I want to find, I can find in New York. I don't know that I could have done it anywhere else. I don't think I want to live in New York forever, but I think that that was the only place I could have possibly gone and decided I wanted to stay for a while.
Because the work you were doing was so challenging and draining, and yet the city had enough positives. That is that what you're saying?
That, but I was actually more just saying, like, because it's so diverse and there's, like, if I wanted Sri Lankan food, I can go get it. Okay. I was more thinking, like, if I want to be immersed in that feeling of, like, being around a bunch of people that are totally different than me, I can do that very easily in New York. But also, yes, what you were saying, like, that there's just so, it's just the best. There's just so much there. There's everything there. And so there is, like, really meaningful hard work, and then, like, all the best entertainment and fun and incredible people. And there's unbelievably incredible, like, inequality, and it's so obvious, and it's an injustice. And then there's, like, these incredible groups and pockets of people that are working so hard and dedicating their whole lives to writing that and to addressing it and to fighting that inequality. There's something for everyone there, I think. So it's a place where people who I feel like maybe don't feel like they fit in other places can go and, like, find a community. Mm-hmm. It can also be incredibly lonely for that reason, because it can be so overwhelming. And so I think there are people that come and just hate it because of that reason. But I think if people are willing to, like, put in a little work to find those communities, it can be found. So, I mean, for the first year, I just had fun. I just worked at a restaurant and didn't know what I was going to do yet. And I did some, like, comedy. I had, like, a hip-hop blog. I just had fun and, like, met incredible people. And then I got my last job, which was working as a counselor, social worker, trauma therapist, whatever, working with people through the Brooklyn Criminal Courthouse, working for a nonprofit that worked in the Brooklyn Criminal Courthouse, doing counseling with people basically as, like, an alternatives to incarceration program. So people who'd been arrested for various low-level crimes, rather than doing short stints at Rikers Island, they would come and do counseling with me or other services or things like that. The main two programs that I worked on was an adolescent alternatives to incarceration, so 16 to 24-year-olds for misdemeanor crimes, and the other one was alternatives to incarceration within the Human Trafficking Intervention Court, which is a thing across New York State, but basically for people who have been arrested for prostitution or prostitution-related charges that would do counseling instead of jail time. So that was the majority of my clientele. It was the hardest thing I've ever done, definitely, and it was incredible and devastating at the same time. I think it loops back to that experience in Chicago of having, you know, seen these things in different countries and having gone and experienced people living in all sorts of different types of terrible situations and challenging situations, and then also, like, really joyful things and seeing all this stuff, and then all of a sudden, like, being back in the country that I was raised in and seeing again this whole other, like, reality of the people that I was working with, who, especially, like, the women coming through the human trafficking court, just the reality that they had experienced was, again, like nothing else I'd ever seen in my life. And the trauma that they'd experienced from really before birth, but then from birth to whenever I was seeing them, and the trauma that they were undoubtedly going to continue experiencing throughout their lives. Just really, it was like it completely destroyed me in a whole new way than anything I'd experienced before.
Was it troubling because it was in your home country?
That was part of it, definitely. I think what I think a couple years of therapy has helped to realize is that I think what was so terrible was that I think just by nature of the things I had done before, the type of, like, trauma that I had observed was a little more structural and systemic. So in Sri Lanka, it was war, which is terrible. And I also wasn't doing clinical work, so I wasn't listening to people's stories very often. And it was, they had experienced the terrible tsunami in 2004 that had killed so many people in that community too. So this like natural disaster, terror and trauma. And again, like in Mexico, what I was doing, the work I was doing was more systemic, the immigration issue and the way that that had traumatized communities. But I wasn't hearing people's individual stories and I wasn't hearing about like intimate, personal trauma. So like one person doing something unbelievably terrible to another person, especially someone that they're supposed to love. So a child, so someone talking about their parent doing terrible things to them or someone or allowing terrible things to happen to them or a partner doing terrible things to them. And that was overwhelmingly what I was hearing, for 7 hours a day, 5 days a week, was just story after story where you just always thought it couldn't get worse of the things that typically women, but everyone I met with, had experienced some type of trauma. I would easily say 100% had experienced some type of trauma. Hearing that and just thinking again, like going back to that question of like, what does it mean to be human? And I think up until then, all my experiences had been like, you want to be happy and you want what's best for your loved ones. And all of a sudden that was wiped away. It was like one of the very few things I had on all my years of traveling, I had settled on was like, in their essence, people want to like take care of their family and the people that they love and they want what's best and deep down people aren't going to hurt each other. And then all of a sudden I was like, well, that's all I'm hearing all day is like people hurting the people closest to them and doing terrible things to them. And it was like the bottom dropped out and I felt like I didn't know. It was so hard to wake up in the morning because I just didn't know the world anymore. It felt like it was a whole new world and it was just devastating. And it was like the first time I was really experiencing like overwhelming anxiety, really bad depression, because it was like that one thing that I had like figured out and it made me feel good, no less, of course, like that this is what humanity is like, we're just trying to make it and take care of each other. And all of a sudden I was like, no, that's not what's happening. So there was that part all day hearing these stories and seeing how it had affected people. And then there's all the contextual, like the bigger, then there is also the systemic oppression and things. So like the poverty that was influencing this and the racism that was influencing this and the sexism that was influencing this and homophobia and transphobia and like all of these, like the isms and the phobias and like the bigger things and being in a courthouse. So watching it in the courthouse every day was probably, I mean, next to the story, the trauma I was hearing, that was easily the worst part because you're seeing it all play out and you're seeing this like parade of people of color coming through predominantly white male judges. And just like, it was like almost too obvious and too painful to see every day. And I had to figure it out. And I'm not really sure I did. I had to leave that job. I mean, I did it for a couple of years. I think I could have done parts of it, but I think altogether, at least for me, I found myself thinking like, I either have to numb out and not feel all this stuff all the time, or I have to leave because I can't feel all of this and be here.
First few months you were working there, coming back to privilege for a quick second, you had said, I never knew that getting to choose when I had sex and if I had sex was a privilege. And that was your first moment. Even obviously when you were working in Sri Lanka and a lot of those other places, you had heard stories about rape or prostitution or something like that. But on a real level, you never recognized the privilege in that, being able to say yes or no. And yet it's happening in communities all over our country.
Right.
But this was just a few years ago that you started this job. You had to see that this was like a reality for so many women in our country and in our communities.
And especially in New York, like Chicago is one thing where it felt close, but Chicago's spaced out. New York, it was literally a half a mile away. Or sometimes I would have clients who I found out lived in my neighborhood, like lived very close to me and had been trafficked in a house that I biked by on my way to work. Mm-hmm. Like that it was so visceral and close and again, yeah, exactly. Like realizing what that meant, how it was happening right in front of me. Like, all these things were happening literally down the street from me, right in front of me, and what that means. And then again, like, thinking about how my privilege then relates to that and the steps in between and, like, the larger policies that are happening of by people who I vote for and things that I could try to lobby for in my own right that, you know, these larger policies that have affected my clients' lives, and then kind of jumping all of that of, like, what does it mean that this is happening in my neighborhood? So, like, and why is sex trafficking happening so rampantly in Brooklyn and in all of New York, but I was working in Brooklyn? And, like, what does that mean? What does it mean that we know where all the pimps are that are trafficking women? I know as soon as they come and they say, this is how I got, and I say, how did you get arrested? And they tell me the situation of how the undercover police officer came up. I can say, oh, were you on this corner? And I know exactly where it is. Mm. And it's like less than a mile from where I live. And there's like, and I feel like there's nothing I can do. What does that even mean? Like, who are we as a society that we know this, that we know this is happening, and that, like, the way that the police target them and are undercover and kind of entrap and, like, go up to or go around the homeless shelters in Brooklyn. They go around the main women's shelter, and as women are standing around who are homeless and often have severe PTSD, severe mental illness, addiction, that they go and offer them very little money undercover and then arrest them and put them in jail. And seeing that happen over and over and over and over and over again. Personally, I was kind of felt like I had lost everything I thought I knew about what it means to be a human. And then as a society, like, seeing our country in a totally different way and saying, like, just the feeling of, like, things working, or ever feeling like there was stability, of being like, this is what it's built on. It's built on things like this, that, like, this is what's happening, and this is the stability, is these women being targeted, and just feeling like there was nothing. There was nothing personal, there was nothing societal that I could, like, build on, and feeling like I was drifting. Like, it just felt, it's obviously hard to describe, like, it felt really crazy in the way that I, like, what it meant, again, identity of, like, how to connect to all of that.
So I'm hearing your mama bear come out. That is what we would call that. So tell us, I guess, like, give us more concrete, like, what is happening? You're on the front lines, and not very few of us are on the front lines. So interpret for us what you are seeing, like, kind of more tangibly, if you will.
I mean, it's obviously, like, a far-reaching, there's so many things involved to, like, affect it. And it all depends on where as well. I mean, one interesting thing to think about is, like, the organization I worked for had programs in almost all the boroughs, not Staten Island, but Bronx, Queens, Manhattan, and Brooklyn. And the Bronx and Brooklyn would be very similar, and Queens and Manhattan would look very similar as far as the type of arrests that were happening. So Manhattan and Queens would be much more, like, upscale happening. They would do stings in hotel rooms. It would be pretty high end, especially Manhattan. Queens would be, there's a larger Asian population in Queens, so they would go into, like, massage parlors.
And when you're saying they, you mean
police.
The police are going in and they are arresting who?
Generally, police go in oftentimes as undercovers, so pretending to be a client, and they'll arrest typically the women. Mm-hmm. The women who are offering sexual services sometimes, sometimes not. Sometimes, a lot of times in massage parlors, they're not. They might be just offering massage, but if they're unlicensed, that's technically labeled as a prostitution offense, in New York at least. So that's typically that. Whereas Brooklyn and the Bronx, the services, sexual services kind of economy, sex work, is typically more outdoor work is what we would call it, and, like, street work. So it's more women working outside on the street, and there would be, like, what we call tracks in certain areas. Typically that kind of work is usually more pimp controlled. Usually women that are controlled by pimps are younger, in my experience. Not always, but a lot of times they are. What that usually looks like is then NYPD would be undercover, would pull up, ask a girl to get in the car, sometimes that's all that it takes. They don't have to take money or anything, and they can arrest them. A lot of times what happens is they'll do that. They'll pull up in a car. They'll pull away. Cop cars will come, arrest her, put her in the back of a van, and they'll just drive around all night and do that and pick up women. Another big charge in Brooklyn and the Bronx especially was called loitering for the purpose of prostitution, which would typically mean, in the way it looked for us, was a woman who had a lot of prostitution charges in her past, who was known by police because she does not have the privilege to leave the community that she's been living in her entire life. Whether or not she's still working, oftentimes is walking to the grocery store at night, that police know her and they can just arrest her and they can charge her with loitering for the purpose of prostitution. And because she has a record, she might even have bail set on her and go to Rikers Island and go to jail because she has a record, regardless of what she's doing, regardless of what clothes she's wearing. Recently, kind of changes in being able to use what clothing a woman is wearing. There was also one about whether or not she had condoms in her purse, which people, you know, blew up at because then women stopped carrying condoms because they could be used against them. And so that a lot of times that's in Brooklyn, at least, that was the clientele, was overwhelmingly women who were coming in for that loitering charge, who had records with prostitution offenses, huge levels of trauma, and then along with that, often mental illness and addiction. And so,
and these were actual stories you're hearing. So, you know, we hear stories in the newspaper or on the news, and you can choose to believe the way they're told or not told. But these are actual stories you're hearing from the mouths of the women. You know, these are not, they're not being funneled through anything other than these women coming to you for the sole purpose of getting, not therapy, obviously, but that you were treated like a therapist in so many of these situations. So it really was, you were hearing their direct experiences in a way that, you know, a woman like you does not normally get to hear these experiences. And your mama bear was definitely poked, but as we were talking leading up to this podcast, what our listeners probably don't know is all three of us were born along the I-80 corridor, which is, as we're coming to find out, one of the biggest places, the biggest routes of sex trafficking. And so even though you're talking about Brooklyn and the boroughs and New York, a place that for us feels so far away and can sometimes feel like a different country when we hear news reports out of New York or even out of Chicago, it feels so different. This is the Midwest. This is the heartland of America. And yet it's happening there too. The stories you're talking about, we can choose to disassociate ourselves with them because that's so far away. But the reality is a lot of our mama bears are probably living around, along one of these major corridors with semi trucks and things like that. And your biggest frustration in a lot of way is the fact that the men, the pimps, are not being prosecuted at the same rate or the same frequency or whatever as the women who, again, are being trafficked or are being used in a way that they've always been used and they know no different, or they don't have the privilege of moving.
Absolutely. And it's a way of seeing power and oppression and privilege play out in that the men who are usually involved are very rarely prosecuted. I mean, it's, of course, again, a very complex issue. Oftentimes the pimps are in relationship with women, and so there is like a domestic violence aspect, and there is love, and sometimes there are children involved, and there's all these other elements that make it hard, because in order to prosecute the men, generally you need the women to testify against them. It's a really complicated thing, but the idea is we know where it's happening, and the NYPD knows where it's happening, and what we see happening is the same poor women of color being arrested over and over and over and over again. As I've gotten into it more and learned more about it, that is how I learned that I-80 is incredibly high rates of, like, trafficking that happen through the Midwest and, like, just all over. And the way that, like, it's in our culture and, like, it's accepted and, like, pimp culture, the way that, like, the role that that's played in hip-hop and in other things, like, the prevalence of that and the privilege in that and, like, the oppression in that of the sexism and male supremacy that happens in, like, in that type of culture. But there's so much to be frustrated with, but it's definitely that of the way that people are prosecuted. Those with the least power tend to be the most exploited over and over and over again. And that even though people are starting to understand, so this idea, we have this human trafficking intervention court, yet the women have to go through the trauma of arrest to get services. Mm-hmm. Like, that was continually just incredibly frustrating. Of, if you're saying that these women might be victims of human trafficking, which, just in case listeners don't know, like, sex trafficking does not have to involve travel. You don't, to be trafficked, you don't have to be brought anywhere. All trafficking involves is being coerced or forced into some type of labor or sex labor. And so that's why just, you know, a lot of pimps, some pimps would be like swab, what we call swab pimps, where they kind of romance usually young girls, often homeless girls, girls that, for whatever reason are more at risk of being exploited. They often are very sweet and take care of them and buy them things that they didn't already have and do all of that until, and then force them to work. And sometimes become violent and sometimes don't. And so, like, seeing, if we're saying that these women that are coming through might be victims of trafficking, why are we making them be arrested? Why are we threatening them that they have to do services or else they're going to go to jail or else they're going to get another conviction? It's this, like, insane, like, re-traumatization that happens in court, which is another reason why I couldn't be in court anymore, that plays out over and over. Or saying you need to testify against your pimp, who may be the father of your child, who maybe you love still, you need to testify against them or you're going to go to jail. That it's just this, like, baffling, the way the system is set up is so, like, baffling. And it was a thing where, similar to, like, Mexico and to these other situations, Mexico related to immigration, where it always felt like if people just heard these stories, like I'm hearing, things would be different. Like, right. So we have all this technology, we have all this, these ways of connecting. So how is it? Because, you know, people like, people in the community that I grew up in, like, who are such good, loving people, that if they knew this was happening, and they might know, but if they heard it from people's mouths, like, there would be, I mean, the idea, for example, to get a domestic violence bed in, a bed at a domestic violence shelter in New York is unbelievably difficult. There's like 100,000 beds, something like a really high number. And to get in, you have to call this one hotline. You have to talk for about an hour, usually. You have to be really detailed about all the different things that have happened to you. You have to say that you are afraid of being killed or of that you're definitely going to be hurt, that you have nowhere else to go. It's a hustle to get a bed to be safe for a night for women. And like, the idea that that exists, you know, it goes back to, like, me trying to think about how I grew up and, like, how these can be in the same country, right. that reality can exist and mine can exist. Like, that doesn't make any sense to me. Mm-hmm. And I think that like, that is, as I go along in my career and, continue to have conversations and to think about these things and to think about what I want to do in the future, there's always that lingering question of, like, how do people hear each other's stories? Like, how do more people hear these stories? Because I know people would be so, like, their mama bear would come out and people would, if anyone sat with any of the women I knew for an hour, like I did all the time, and heard their stories, they would want to, I know people would be like, that's insane. What can I do? Like, how can I support you? What can I do to change? It's just that, like, there is such a separation and there is, like, this disconnect. Mm-hmm. That people just aren't able to hear those stories. But if they could, I know people would want to do similar things. People would definitely want to, like, do whatever they could, I'm sure.
So listeners that are hearing these stories, what would you say? Like, if they're just like, but I can do something, Kate. Like, what can I do?
Well, I think a large thing is that it's happening in your community. So wherever you are, like, domestic violence is definitely happening. Coercive sex is happening. Sexual assault is definitely happening. I mean, I would venture to say some sort of trafficking, which is coercive labor, is happening. It may not just be women, of course. I think people being targeted for their different forms, like lack of power and lack of privilege in certain ways, is definitely happening. So I think one thing that I thought about a lot was then, you know, coming back even to the community that I grew up in, which was always, like I said, very comfortable and safe for me. And I knew that wasn't the case for everybody, but I think coming back, and now my dad, your father-in-law, is involved in politics in our community, and just talking to him about it and saying, like, are there homeless shelters? Is there a domestic violence shelter? is it used? Is it at capacity? Is there a domestic violence court? Is there a mental health court? Like, just asking questions like that about the community, saying if a 16-year-old girl becomes homeless or if a 16-year-old boy comes out as gay to his family and is kicked out, where do they go? Like, what happens? Those are the highest, at very high risk. Where do they go?
What's our community doing to support them? You're exactly. saying ask your leaders of your community these questions.
Totally. Or just, yeah, looking and getting to know your community better. And so mm-hmm. knowing where those people that are at highest risk, so the poor, people of color, those who may have mental illness, those who may have experienced trauma, those who are currently facing addiction or have had addictions in the past and substance abuse, where do they go when they need help? And then just recognizing that, because that's I mean, so much of it, of the people that I lived, if they had had one person, literally just one person to take care of them and to support them and to help them through a rough time, they might have had different realities. And so I think just like being aware of that in your community, of what those services are and what those options are for people when they need them, and then see where the gaps are and fill them, and like work towards filling them in your own community. If there's not a domestic violence shelter, you know, whatever, like there seems to be a high need at, or even, you know, things like kids getting arrested in school, who's getting arrested, like what's going on, why are they getting, just knowing your community better, and knowing what services are and aren't in place is like the biggest way that anybody anywhere can be involved, because that's the only way you're going to know better. You can read a lot of like interesting, like long form articles about the sex trade and sex work and trafficking and all these things that may reference places around you. But if you want to know what it looks like and want to do something about it, you have to get to know your own community, and you have to know those parts of your community.
And so many of our listeners are doing that. And so I'd love to hear just like, what, tell us where to go. Where are the places that are doing good things and help each other find other places to support and help?
So why should we care, though? As you were talking, I was thinking, this comes back to privilege. I have tremendous privilege in the fact that I don't have to care. There's no part of me living in where I do in Michigan that has to care. I can raise my kids in this Midwest lifestyle that does have two parents who love them tremendously and will do anything for them and can feed them and can give them shelter and all of that. So why should we care? Why should the mama bears find this stuff out about their community? Why should they support the organizations who are doing a great, great work on these areas and other areas in their communities? Why do you think we need to care about it?
I mean, I think in the most pragmatic way, those relate to issues that everybody cares about. So immigration is something like nationally, but also in most communities, it is a conversation, especially even in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. It's a huge conversation about, because of jobs and economics and things like that. There's, of course, the self-interest of wanting to take care of your own kids and your own, like, your daughters. I think about your daughters all the time and, like, the risks that they face based on their different identities and things like that. And your sons and the risks that they face, of course. So beyond that of wanting to care for your own, I think it's understanding that, like, working in a courthouse and working with the people that I worked with, the idea of, like, what crime is and how we deal with crime and how we punish crime and how we rehabilitate those who commit crime or don't, in most cases, I think that whole idea is something that affects everyone, obviously, and the way that we vote affects that. And so I think understanding those things, if a certain type of, like, crime is happening, understanding that who is committing that and why they might be committing that, and kind of just giving, like, larger context to, like, almost any societal issue that we have and the way that, like, that affects everyone. Mm-hmm. And so I think if people were to feel that they could be completely siloed off, which might be the case, that would include, like, then you don't care, you don't vote, you don't care about, like, politics. And so if you vote, you care. You clearly care about what's happening in your community, what's happening in the country. There's something about all of that that makes you, that would make you care enough to discuss politics, to want to vote, to want to be, do anything in that area. And so I think in that case, that's a part of the conversation. So that's in the most pragmatic of understanding that, like, those types of communities and the policies that affect the most oppressed and the most in need affect everybody. They affect all of us. And then I think, like, beyond that, it kind of, I mean, personally, like, as I've come to see that, in those moments of being with the people that I've worked with and hearing those stories, as, like, utterly devastating as it was at times, it was also, like, the most human I've ever felt. It was almost like harkening back to, like, mm-hmm. Sri Lanka, where it wasn't about the words. It was about being with someone in that pain. And, like, I've other than maybe Sri Lanka, never felt as alive as I did in those moments, and felt like this is, it was part of what was confusing, because it was so painful, but it was also, like, felt like the only, like, the most right thing I've ever done, in that just, like, sharing with someone and having them tell me, the first time meeting me, telling me this terrible thing that happened to them that they've never said to anyone else in their entire lives. But because I gave them that safe space for an hour where they could feel like they could say something, whatever they needed to say to me, was, like, incredible. And I think that I just want people to experience that. Like, I want people to, like, see that, and to see that, like, those are women that have the opposite, like, upbringing, life, reality that I did. And in that moment, it was just, like, two humans, like, supporting each other and connecting and allowing people to, like, feel what they were feeling. And that's, like, incredible. And I truly believe that if we could, like, bridge that gap, so much of, like, what's happening in our country, like, and just the divide, the like, strong divide that's happening in a few different ways, in that always comes out in election season, but more and more every year, or every election cycle, that so much of that would be bridged if mm-hmm. people could just, like, share, like, even just literally, like, a second of that, like, communion between two humans. I think things would get so much better.
That's incredible. I love that so much. And it reminds me of a friend of mine. She calls that kind of a pile of puppies moment. And she tells the story of grief and of grieving with her friends over the death of a child, and how there were no words. There was just, what they created was a safe space where they were literally sitting so close to one another, just physically touching, that she was like, we were like a pile of puppies, just, like, absolutely, in it together, and just existing in that moment of just, like, love and grief. And so, yeah, that's, I always call it the pile of puppies now, and I think, like, that's
such a great, you know, you can visualize that so well. And I think we've talked about it before on this podcast, Leslie, that, one, the power of story, the fact that mm-hmm. every single person in the world has a story, and then being a witness to the story. That's one of the reasons we started this podcast, mm-hmm. is because we believe that every person out there, but women in particular, have this really interesting and extraordinary story to tell. And I've been close to tears 22 times this podcast taping, because there's something miraculous about witnessing someone telling their story. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of the people, not just women, that you've been able to be in a room with, they've never felt power in their story. They've never felt any kind of agency. And so to have a woman like you, who, again, has privilege and power that they've never seen or never felt, it's got to feel incredible to be able to unload their burden and have you say, I see you, and absolutely, I recognize you, and what has happened to you is not okay. To never have heard that before, I mean, I just cannot imagine, even if that strength lasts for the hour that you talk to them and then disappears the second right. they get on the sidewalk, which probably it does, mm-hmm. there's something really extraordinary about that moment of two people connecting.
And I think, I totally agree, and I think, too, I mean, Kate has had some extraordinary experiences that, you know, as a stay-at-home mom in the middle of the country, you don't feel like you really have access to. But there's that moment we always say in our introduction that, you know, you're in Target and your kid's screaming and you can't reach the granola on the top shelf. Like, that's your moment to connect with another, you know, you yes. see this happening, you look them in the eye, and you, in that moment, you're communicating that I see you, that your struggle is my struggle, and we're all in this together. I think those moments can happen in the most incredible and mundane ways.
Yeah. Getting back a little bit to me asking you, why should we care? If you haven't yet realized, either in your own personal life or from this podcast, we belong together. So when a woman in Brooklyn gets prosecuted again for prostitution, even though this is something that, because of how she was raised or because of this pimp who's, it affects me. It really does affect me because we belong to each other. And it might not, I might be benefiting from that, you know, I mean, but you have to realize that we are all in this together. The woman in the Target, not, you know, with the screaming kid, not having showered in an unknown amount of time, or that woman in Brooklyn who I will never meet or never actually see. It's so important to be able to acknowledge a physical I see you, and then just you know, metaphysical, I see you. I see these women who are unseen by most of our country. And just, we have the power to give up our privilege of not having to see them and say, you know what, it's more important that I see it. It's more important that I use the privilege I have to be able to vote, to be able to call my mayor, to be able to call my senator or my congressperson and say, what are you doing to make sure that this isn't happening in my community, to make sure that we have a support system for everybody.
Right.
Because Leslie and I have had the opportunity to kind of get a first row seat into watching you struggle with the privilege. But has it been worth it? Because like you said, you've had to go to therapy. You have been, in the last few years, there have been moments where we've just been so worried about you, more your mental health.
Mm-hmm.
With all of that, knowing all of that, is it still worth it to you?
I've definitely thought about it a lot. Like, if, I mean, it doesn't matter because I can't unsee and unhear things. It was important for me to think through, if I could unsee it and unhear it and unknow things, would I want to do that? I think that when I think back, like I said, like, some of those experiences have brought, like, the most emotional and mental pain in my life, but at the same time, the most, like, joyous things that I can think of, other than maybe, like, playing with my nieces and nephews and being with my partner, are those moments where I come home just exhausted and full of, like, pretty terrible stories, but thinking, like, God, like, that was exactly what I meant to do. Like, that there's nothing else I want to do but, like, be that present with someone. And that feeling of that connection that I was describing, like, there's nothing like it. There's nothing like it, and there's nothing that feels more real to me. It's been more of a process of, like, now I need to figure out how to do that in an environment and in a position that is more sustainable for me, that I'm not coming home with quite as many, like, nightmares in my head, and trying to figure that out with my new position in a high school and going forward, but figuring out how to have that moment, and be aware of those things in every part of my life, not just my job, but when I go home and every day with the things that I read and the news that I watch and things like that. But doing it in a way that I have to be able to sleep at night. Mm-hmm. I have to be able to sleep. I have to be able to eat, because there was a time where I couldn't do either of those things.
Right.
And so I have to do these things that allow me to exist and to, like, survive and to live. And being way more aware of the people that I surround myself with, and blessed or lucky to be in, like, a loving, supportive relationship, and how important that has been, and the way that I've, like, harnessed, like, my relationships with my family and my friends, just, like, being so much more aware of that, and realizing that with all of that, I can do it, because it's totally worth it, and that it's definitely worth it, and I wouldn't want to, like, go back and change that.
Yeah.
So, Kate, you are welcome for teaching you everything you know. We are so proud of you.
I'm so appreciative to you guys.
But no, thank you for talking to us and for sharing your amazing life. You've done so much for an almost 30-year-old. You've really
been able to do amazing things. And thanks for taking the time to share them with our listeners.
Thanks so much for having me.
Love you, sister.
Love you.
Okay, bye. All right, Mama Bears. Today we dare you to unpack your privilege. This might require some alone time in a journal. It might require some research into people from other communities and other cultures as well. Were you born knowing you would have 3 meals and a few snacks every day? Were you born into a family that always had a safe house? Did your parents do the very best to love you and support you the best way they knew how? Are you white? Do you have a name that sounds fairly common and has no hint of other in it? Do you have at least one or more people you could call to borrow money if you fell onto hard times? These are just a few ways privilege might be working in your life. Mama Bears, today we just ask you to unpack your privilege a little bit so that you might better understand the mama bear next to you that might have a different outlook on life, the one that didn't grow up with the same privileges. We aren't telling you to feel guilt or shame about your privilege. Privilege, by definition, is something you haven't done anything to deserve. We're just asking you to identify it. Because once you've identified it, you can use it. If you're able to have a bigger voice, use it to amplify the voices that our culture refuses to hear. If you have access to disposable income, find nonprofits in your area that are helping make your community safer, healthier, and more welcoming for those members of our society not afforded the same privileges. And most of all, Mama Bear, use your privilege to tear down the narrative of us versus them. Right now, our world is trying to make us choose lanes and then hate on anyone else not in our lane. Remember your shared humanity, Mama Bear. Remember that not much separates us from the other lanes other than these identities and privileges that have been thrust on us. This is hard but important work. It's work that builds bridges instead of walls. And as Mama Bears, we want to remember that we were made to use our instincts to further the ideas of love and compassion. So use your privilege and your Mama Bear instinct to reach out a hand across aisles, oceans, and walls. We belong to each other, Mama Bear. Dare to respond out of love and compassion instead of fear and judgment.
Aww. That was beautiful.
Thanks.
I'm not much of a crier, but that made me teary a little bit. That was fantastic. That was so amazing. You guys, thank you, Tessie, for writing that. And thank you, everyone, for sticking with us through this two-part sister-in-law extravaganza. And remember to join our community online to connect with us and tell us what you thought about these episodes. Where do you see your privilege playing out in the world? Have you ever really sat down to think about it? We want to hear from you. And please, Mama Bears, take a moment to give us a rating and a review on iTunes. We ask you to do that so that we can reach more Mama Bears, so that we can find a bigger community who wants to tackle the issues of today alongside of us. If you have a Mama Bear in your life who you think we need to hear about, please email us at mamabeardares@gmail.com. Of course, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We would love to hear from you. This world is big and complicated. We crave a community to share, and we hope you'll be a part of it.
Yeah. Have an awesome week, Mama Bears.
Thanks for listening. Have a great week.